From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the former president of Planned Parenthood, Faye Waddleton. She headed the organization from 1978 to 92. Many of her opponents were fundamentalist Christians who opposed abortion. Waddleton grew up in a fundamentalist family, which she says helped her understand the perspective of her opponents. She's written a new autobiography. Also, the new film Big Night is Stanley Tucci's homage to the Italian food he was raised on. We'll have a review from John Powers and talk to Tucci, who co-wrote, co-directed, and co-stars in the new film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Larry Matthews. Rescuers off the coast of Peru report wreckage, but no survivors and no bodies following the crash early today of an Aero Peru jetliner carrying 70 people on a flight from Miami to Lima. The Boeing 757 went down in the Pacific Ocean 3 miles from the Peruvian coast. Two large sections of the plane have been found. The pilot had reported problems just before the crash. A Peruvian Air Force spokesman says the plane was experiencing electrical problems. Dense fog is hampering the rescue effort. Before dawn, local officials had set up lights on the beach to guide any survivors to shore. None was spotted. A snag has developed in the Middle East summit talks in Washington. Secretary of State Warren Christopher conducted low-level talks at the State Department this morning and then recommended that a planned meeting at the White House be delayed until, as the White House puts it, they do some more work. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat were to go to the White House to meet with President Clinton. No word when that meeting will take place. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators met all night. The two-day talks are to wind up today, but U.S. officials say serious differences remain. As Israeli and Palestinian leaders meet in Washington today, Palestinians threw stones at Israeli soldiers in several places on the West Bank. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
In the West Bank town of Hebron, Palestinians threw stones at the soldiers when a curfew was lifted for a few hours to allow residents to stock up on food. The town, which is at the center of the debate in Washington, has been under curfew for 5 days. Israeli soldiers were under orders not to inflame the situation, and while they chased the stone throwers, they did not fire rubber bullets or tear gas. Palestinian youth in Bethlehem also threw stones at soldiers, but were stopped by Palestinian policemen. The West Bank and Gaza Strip remain tense, and Israeli army officials say they fear a new outbreak of violence if there's no progress at the Washington summit. Some Palestinians hoarded food, fearing a prolonged Israeli curfew. More than 70 people died in last week's violence. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Robert Kim, the man accused of providing top-secret U.S. information to South Korea, is going to remain in jail. A federal judge in Alexandria, Virginia, today denied bail for Kim, overriding a federal magistrate who had set a bond for Kim. Kim is a former civilian employee of the Naval Intelligence Services. Federal prosecutors had challenged the magistrate's order permitting bail, saying they think he is likely to flee. The judge noted that Kim no longer has a job, is deeply in debt, and has close ties to his native South Korea. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 2.84 at 5930.99 in moderate trading of 192 million shares. This is NPR News. The Los Angeles Times reports this morning that former LAPD detective Mark Furman will be charged with perjury for statements made on the witness stand during the murder trial of O.J. Simpson. Furman could enter a plea as early as today, NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
It was Furman who found the bloody glove in the grounds of Simpson's property that appeared to be the made-for-one found at the crime scene. But Furman also said on the stand that he did not remember having used a particular racial epithet for African Americans in the past 10 years. Later, Furman would be heard using that word numerous times in research tapes recorded by an aspiring screenwriter. When he was recalled to the stand, Furman took the fifth, and this controversy is believed to have played a significant role in Simpson's acquittal on the two murder charges. The charges against Furman are the result of an investigation by the California Attorney General's office, Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti maintained during the trial that perjury charges would only be relevant if the testimony in question had related to evidence directly concerning the murder charges against Simpson. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Another report showing the economy may be heating up. The Commerce Department says construction spending jumped 0.9% in August, the fourth increase in the last 6 months. The August increase followed a revised 1.1% drop in construction spending in July. The August jump was the largest increase since April, and it is in line with analysts' opinions that the Federal Reserve may be forced to up short-term interest rates soon to slow down the economy to avoid a surge in inflation. Efforts to revive the peace process in Angola are stalled. Jonas Savimbi, the leader of the former guerrilla group UNITA, didn't show up at scheduled peace talks in Luanda today, sending a note instead. The talks were organized by South African President Nelson Mandela and other regional leaders in hopes of saving the peace agreement, which ended the civil war there. I'm Larry Matthews, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After serving 14 years as the national president of Planned Parenthood, Faye Waddleton has written an autobiography. In 1978, she became Planned Parenthood's youngest president ever, its first African-American president, and the first woman to head the organization since its founder, Margaret Sanger. Under Waddleton's leadership, Planned Parenthood became an activist group, constantly in the forefront of the debate over sex education, birth control, and abortion. The transformation in the agency's image made Waddleton a controversial figure inside as well as outside Planned Parenthood. Outside, many of her most forceful adversaries were fundamentalist Christians who opposed abortion. You may be surprised to learn that Waddleton is from a fundamentalist background. When Faye Waddleton was growing up, her mother was an itinerant preacher in the Church of God. She's now a minister in Atlanta. I asked Faye Waddleton to share some childhood memories of her mother's preaching.
It was very forceful. My mother had her first calling to the ministry at the age of 17, and she was the eldest daughter of a minister, so that she had also learned the art of ministry from her father. I am told that even at a young age, she was very compelling in her message, very dedicated to her work. And that was really what characterized most of her life and her ministry. I mean, it was very powerful. She would stand in one position at the pulpit. She did not jump around. She did not emote a great deal. She read various passages from the Bible to underscore the point that she tried to make. And within minutes after she took the rostrum, people were transfixed in silent attention. And I, as a child, of course, watched that night after night, in week after week, month after month, as we traveled around the country where my mother was a speaker for revival meetings.
You say that she often focused on the sins of the flesh, fornication and adultery. What would she say?
Well, she would speak of them just in those terms. It was not more explicit, but she spoke of adultery. She spoke of referred to it as in the Ten Commandments against adultery. She spoke against fornication, that is, sexual relationships outside marriage. She spoke against homosexuality. Her views were that God loved the person but did not love the behavior. And of course, her mission was to call people from sin and into a life that was in strict reliance to and accommodation to the teachings of the Bible as she interpreted them.
Did you ever break away from your mother's religion? And if so, did you find a new way of expressing faith?
Well, what I try to say in the book is that my life has really been an evolution. And I think from the time that I can remember, I wanted to be a missionary nurse. Now, I'm sure that this was at the suggestion of my mother, although I don't quite remember the moment in which it was offered as my future. But I always wanted to be a nurse, and that was my dream. That was my ambition. My mother also wanted me to have a college education, and so that sort of set me on a path of looking at nursing programs that were in college or university settings. I ended up at Ohio State, and by that time, I wasn't so interested in mission work, that is, going abroad to serve in mission hospitals, but rather in the consumption of my preparation for nursing. And it was really during those years that I began to evolve away from the strict teachings of my parents. I did try to go to church at the beginning of my college years, but then it became too difficult and the workload became so demanding. I worked my way through college. But it was during those years that I saw people who suffered. I did not see people who were evil because they did not belong to the same church that I had been reared in. I did not find myself caught up in all of the dangers of sin that I had been warned against. But more importantly, the nursing profession really more than anything shaped my values about the importance of not judging my patients as a condition for caring for them. And this was a very important departure because, you see, I had been raised in a very judgmental environment, a very strict environment, one in which adherence to the standards was absolute and a divergence was not tolerated. So that within a nursing preparation context, I really began to evolve into a wider consideration of other possibilities.
Faye Waddleton is my guest. She was the head of National Planned Parenthood from 1978 to 92. Now she has a memoir called Life on the Line. You often debated Randall Terry and other fundamentalist anti-abortion activists. Were there arguments that these activists would make that you already knew inside out because of your upbringing?
Well, I certainly knew the strength of the conviction that those who opposed my work held. And I knew that it was governed by a religious belief that was not transient, that it was something that really was an obligation for the followers to pursue. If one is to be worthy of the life of paradise hereafter, then the teachings require that we adhere to those standards on earth. And so it was really more of the perspective with which they brought to the table that I understood, and really the mandate, if I guess would be the best way to describe it, under which they worked. And while I did not share that view, and I can't say that there were any explicit arguments, because in my household we did not talk about sexual subjects. Certainly the question of birth control and abortion never came up. It did not come up in my mother's sermons either. But I understood the perspective of their fervency. And I also knew that if that fervency were channeled into a political mandate, it could be very dangerous, because there is no one to temper it. Because, you see, the message is that God requires this. And what we were seeing in the late 70s and early 80s were the ministers of fundamentalist denominations compelling their followers to be more political and positioning their religious views as important political mandates for which God was requiring their followers to adhere and to promote and, in fact, to try to get laws to impose.
How would you describe the approach you developed to debating your fundamentalist opponents?
Well, I think it comes from my roots in that I understood the mandate, or their belief in the mandate that they had to carry out. I also had watched my mother many, many years advancing her point of view and never emoting. I mean, she's a very straightforward communicator. While she did not have to debate the point of view, she certainly was able to express herself and never lost focus on what she wanted to say. I think that the reason I was able to debate the opponents to reproductive rights over the years that I served as the president of Planned Parenthood so calmly and so strongly without compromise really emanates more from the experiences that I had before I came to the position than any particular debate technique. As a nurse and trained as a nurse midwife, I saw the circumstances that women found themselves in when they were pregnant and did not want to. I trained in the years when birth control was still illegal in some states, and certainly abortion was illegal throughout the country. I worked my way through college at Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, and I saw the experiences or the examples of battered children, of children who had been abused, who had been neglected. So I really came to the debate not from an idea that I had or a conversion that I had, but really from an enormous wealth of experiences. I delivered babies in Harlem Hospital. I cared for women who were injured as a result of illegal and botched abortions. I cared for a young woman who actually died from an abortion. So it was impossible for me to close those situations off in my experience and act as though they did not exist when in the heat of the debate. And it was from those experiences that I always felt the strength to make the point of view and not to get caught up in the emotions of the debate, but to continue to argue the point that these are issues that protect women's lives.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Faye Waddleton. She was the head of National Planned Parenthood from 1978 to 92. Now she's written an autobiography called Life on the Line. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Faye Waddleton, the former national president of Planned Parenthood, now the author of a new autobiography called Life on the Line. Faye Waddleton, you trained as a nurse midwife. Then when you took over National Planned Parenthood in 1978, you led it in a much more activist direction. You led it into the national arena for reproductive rights with an emphasis on abortion rights. Why did you want to see the organization head more in that activist direction?
Well, Planned Parenthood is the largest provider of reproductive health services in the country. I came to the national position after running a local chapter of Planned Parenthood in Dayton, Ohio for 7.5 years. And so I knew the important work that was going on in our clinics and the educational programs in our communities. But I also felt that that gave us a special obligation to speak on behalf of those that I knew did not have the power to speak, the kids that we saw in our clinics, the poor women, the sick women, the well-off women who felt that they could not go elsewhere but had to come to Planned Parenthood. So who was going to speak for them if those of us who were serving them every day did not speak up on their behalf? And so it seemed to me to be the natural extension of our service mission to be an advocate for the people whom we served and who were now in danger of losing their rights to those services if we did not defend them.
As Planned Parenthood became more of an activist organization, how did your funding picture change? Where did you lose funding? Where did you gain funding?
Well, our funding was under threat from the very early years of my time at Planned Parenthood, because after the Reagan election, the opposition to Planned Parenthood became more focused. So our funding was an immediate focus of attack. Now, this was not just about abortion funding. We were talking about family planning programs were under attack, those programs that were designed to prevent the need for abortion. And we fought opposition to rules that would have required us to report to parents when their teenage daughters came to our clinics. We fought rules that would have required us to withhold information from women about abortion. Domestically, we were able to hold the line on those rules, even though they were passed and they attempted to impose them for a variety of reasons, they were not implemented. Internationally, we were not able to hold the line. We did lose our funding for our international programs because we would not agree to withhold information from women in the developing world where deaths occur at the rate of about 200,000 a year as a result of illegal abortion. And as a result of that, the Bush and the Reagan administrations sought and eventually cut off the right to cut off our funding for international programs.
When the radical fringe of the anti-abortion movement turned violent, many Planned Parenthoods turned into fortresses for the protection of the patients and the people who worked there. I'm wondering what effect that had on your morale and on the morale of other people who worked at Planned Parenthoods around the country.
Well, I think it was very difficult, and it is difficult. The harassment continues. It has persisted for many years. I think it is regrettable that it was not until someone was killed and until the destruction of clinics just became so impossible to ignore, that there seemed to be an appreciation for how dangerous the opposition to reproductive rights had become. I mentioned that the first clinic bombing of a Planned Parenthood affiliate occurred in 1977, only 4 years after Roe v. Wade, which was a Supreme Court decision that recognized a legal right to abortion. So this violence has had a very long and difficult history, and the affiliates were often under siege. As you described, they had to install very sophisticated security systems to prevent the destruction of their clinics and also the harm to their patients and to themselves.
What were the debates inside Planned Parenthood like about what kind of security you should have, whether there should be armed guards there?
There were no debates about that. In fact, we had to accept the reality, and here Planned Parenthood stood without equivocation that we were not going to close down our clinics, that we would not give in to the violent ways of our opposition, because it would only empower them to go on and to seek more and more dangerous methods of intimidation. So there were no arguments over the need to secure our clinics, and the national organization tried to help the affiliates by instructing them on the very best way to do this. We had very close working relationships with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Unfortunately, the Federal Bureau of Investigation was not as aggressively involved in identifying the more violent elements of the anti-abortion movement, but we did the best that we could to secure the affiliate clinics as well as their patients.
Did you ever wear a bulletproof shield?
I did not wear a bulletproof shield, but I did, from time to time, have to submit to the protection of guards. When death threats came over the switchboard and they were believed to be serious enough, at least for a while, to increase the security around my public appearances, though I did not like the invasion of my privacy and to have someone present with me at all times, I realized the necessity of it. But I also believed that I was not going to let the prospect of violence or harm stop my work, and that I just couldn't worry about it. If someone really wanted to harm me, I was resigned to the fact that they would do so. But that as long as I was silent against these violent forces, they would have their will and their way. And that a very important part of my work was to say that we cannot tolerate this violence. We must, speak and work aggressively against the harassment, because it does promote a violent atmosphere that will allow or, in fact, encourage someone more perhaps unstable to take more aggressive means to impose their point of view.
Do you know if anyone actually tried to hurt you?
There were a couple of experiences that I described that were pretty frightening to me. One that took place after the end of a speech when a father stood up and condemned me very vigorously, verbally, for encouraging his child to violate her parents' and her family's teachings. And he threw an object at me that hit me and struck me in the chest. And for a moment, I thought that he had a gun. And it was a very frightening moment. I was at the podium, unprotected. And as they say, your life sort of begins to trail in front of you. But it only turned out to be a package of unused birth control pills or partially used birth control pills. But it was really a very frightening moment when I realized how vulnerable I was, but also an empowering moment because I realized that there was really nothing that I could do and that at least for as long as I was allowed to, I was going to continue the work, and I just simply couldn't think about it. I took reasonable precautions, and when it was advisable to accept more serious protection, I did so, but I never did so for very long periods of time. When I did make public speeches, there were in the latter years always there was security, but that was really about the extent of it in terms of a consistent level of security.
The so-called abortion pill RU486 was conditionally approved by the FDA, so it looks like women will have the option of using that sometime soon in the United States. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this pill.
Well, this is a pill that was developed in France and has been used in Europe for almost a decade now. We have attempted to get this pill approved for use by women in this country as an alternative to surgical abortion for many years. And it's unfortunate that it has taken so long, but I'm glad that it's finally happened. It is not something that will be an easy solution for an unintended pregnancy because it does require several office visits and the physician's care, but it does allow for a woman who may not want to submit to a surgical abortion when she desires to end an unintended pregnancy, an alternative. There's also methotrexate, which is an anti-cancer drug that is also now being considered as another medical method of terminating a pregnancy. Some would say that this will end the abortion debate. I don't agree. This has not been an issue about a surgical technique. It has been an issue of whether women will have the right to have full control over their reproduction. And RU486 gives another tool for women to control their reproduction. And I am certain that those people who are opposed to that fundamental power and freedom will continue to fight the battles.
Faye Waddleton, I have one last question for you. When you were the head of Planned Parenthood, you fought very hard for the right of women to choose to have an abortion. You were brought up in a very strict Christian fundamentalist family that didn't believe in contraception, let alone abortion. Do you think that you could have had an abortion yourself? Would your own faith allow you to have one if you wanted to?
I don't know what would have happened if I had been faced with that circumstance, but if the conditions were such that it was in my best interest, either for my health or my welfare, I would, and I believe that I could have faced that situation. Would I have preferred to not face it? Absolutely, and I'm glad that I did not have to. But I do not believe that I would have, under no condition, said that this is not something that I would have done.
Faye Waddleton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Faye Waddleton was the national president of Planned Parenthood from 1978 to 92. Her new autobiography is called Life on the Line. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I eat Aunt the pasta twice just because she is so nice, Angelina.
Actor Stanley Tucci got tired of playing the heavy, so he created the kind of character he wanted to portray. Coming up, we'll talk with Tucci about co-writing, co-directing, and starring in Big Night, a film about food, money, and Louis Prima. And John Powers will review the film.
The waitress at the pizzeria, ti voglio bene, Angelina, I adore you. Viva you bene,
viva you bene,
Angelina, I live for you. In passione,
basta passione,
you have set my heart on fire. But Angelina,
signorina,
never
listens to my song. I eat antipasto twice just because she is so nice, Angelina. Angelina, the waitress at the pizzeria. If she'll be a my cara mia, then I'll join in matrimony with the girl who serves spumoni, and Angelina will be mine.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stanley Tucci is usually cast as the heavy. Perhaps he's now best known for his role as the accused in last season's episodes of Murder One. Now he's starring in Big Night, a movie comedy about family, food, and the eternal conflict between art and commerce. Tucci also co-wrote and co-directed the film. We'll talk with him about it in just a few minutes. First, a review from our film critic, John Powers.
Ever since eating replaced sex as our culture's biggest turn-on, we've seen more and more movies about cooks. And this makes perfect sense. Whether it's Tampopo, Babette's Feast, or Like Water for Chocolate, one thing is clear. Audiences are eager to devour an enjoyable movie about food. In the new film Big Night, the Italian food looks so sumptuous it'll probably send you running to the nearest trattoria. But Big Night is much more than just a celluloid aperitif. This tender comedy is one of the year's very best movies. Set on the New Jersey shore in the late 1950s, Big Night is the story of Primo and Secondo Pelagi, immigrant brothers who own a small restaurant named Paradise. Their business is failing because Primo, played by Tony Shalhoub, is a wizard chef who insists on cooking the refined Italian cuisine that didn't catch on in the States until the 1970s. Secondo, played by Stanley Tucci, is the front man. Both maitre d' and waiter, he looks longingly at the crowded Italian restaurant up the street, with its lounge singer belting O Sole Mio, and its dishes that come wreathed in spectacular flames. Its owner, Pascal, wonderfully played by Ian Holm, keeps urging the brothers to adopt American ideas of success. Give people what they want, he says. What they want becomes painfully clear each time Secondo serves their unadventurous patrons one of his brother's sophisticated dishes.
Excuse me, didn't you say that this was going to be rice with seafood?
Yes. Yeah. That is, Italian arboreal rice, the best. Right. And then with shrimp and scallop and...
I just don't see anything that looks like a shrimp or a scallop. It's not what I expected. But I get a side order of spaghetti with this, right?
Why? Well, no.
I thought all main courses come with spaghetti.
Well, some, yes, but you see, risotto is rice, so it is a starch, and it doesn't go really with pasta.
But I don't...
Honey, order a side of spaghetti, that's all. And I'll eat your meatballs.
Yeah, he'll have the meatballs.
Well, the spaghetti comes without meatballs.
There are no meatballs with the spaghetti?
No, sometimes spaghetti likes to be alone.
Big Night's directors, Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott, are two actors who've obviously grown weary of giving people what Hollywood wants. In fact, their movie is something of a love letter to the great Italian comedies of the 50s and 60s, especially the early work of Fellini. Big Night is funny, but not in the flatulent vein of Jim Carrey or Eddie Murphy. It's worldly, not vulgar. And it loves its characters instead of mocking them. The movie's all about keeping your integrity while trying to survive, but it doesn't belabor the point. Instead, it lovingly captures the poetry in small details, like Secondo's fussy way of straightening the chairs before opening time, or Primo's slow burn when his brother suggests dropping risotto from the menu. Tony Shalhoub is marvelously droll as Primo, who'd sooner return to Italy than sacrifice his principles to the criminals and Philistines who prefer bad food. While Secondo reveres his older brother's artistry, he also wants to make enough money to get married and buy a Cadillac. Not so much to ask, really. Secondo is the richest role of Tucci's career, and he's both funny and moving as a decent, deeply divided man who's always hustling in an attempt to please everyone, his idealistic brother, his fiancée Phyllis, and his demanding lover Gabriella, who just happens to be his friend Pascal's wife. She's played by Isabella Rossellini in her wittiest performance ever. As the title suggests, the whole movie builds to one big night. To publicize their restaurant, the brothers invite the famous bandleader Louis Prima to join them and their friends for a special feast. Naturally, events spin out of control in an explosion of food and wine and emotional fireworks. But what makes Big Night special is not this bravura sequence, but its aftermath, once everything gets quiet again. The movie ends with the year's loveliest scene, in which cooking an omelet leads to the brothers' reconciliation, both with each other and with their shared destiny. Far more satisfying in its nuances than most films are in their grandiose effects, Big Night is risotto in a world of spaghetti and meatballs.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. We'll talk with Stanley Tucci about the making of Big Night after a break. This is Fresh Air. Big Night is likely to change Stanley Tucci's image in Hollywood. Tucci has played heavies in such films as Kiss of Death, The Pelican Brief, and Billy Bathgate. The TV series Wise Guy helped launch his career and show off what an effective bad guy he could be. More recently, the TV series Murder One widened his following. He starred as the accused murderer Richard Cross. I asked Tucci what he wanted to do in Big Night that he wasn't able to do in his previous roles.
I wanted to carry a picture, meaning, you know, play the guy who we follow from beginning to end. I wanted also to try to create an ambiguous leading man, a man who was not incredibly heroic. And so often in films, I think particularly American films, we see the leading man is always some sort of hero, and he's without a lot of faults, and I wanted this character to be very human and to see if the audience would indeed care about him.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you tired of playing the heavy in movies also?
I'm so tired of it, I can't tell you.
It's too bad. You know, I really like you as the heavy. Does that bother you to hear me say that?
No, it doesn't. No, I'm very flattered, and I really, listen, I have no problem playing the heavy if it is an interestingly written role, if there's a complexity to it, if there's a humanity to the
mm-hmm,
role.
Mm-hmm.
What I do have difficulty with is that so often I'm asked to play the heavy only because I'm Italian. And I think that happens very often to a lot of Italian American actors. It's the prevailing view of the Italian American in Hollywood is a pretty bleak one. And it's something that won't go away. It's been around since really film began. And that's what I'm tired of. That's what I'm tired of most of all. If I can have a varied career, and I've been very lucky. I mean, I've done a lot of different things, but inevitably there's always that mafia stuff that keeps cropping up. And one of the reasons we made this picture is to change that.
Now, it's funny. I mean, the two things that Italians are associated with most in movies mm-hmm. are organized crime and mm-hmm. pasta, right?
Right.
So you're rejecting the organized crime thing, but you are kind of heading in the pasta direction, if you know what I mean. It's a film very
right.
much about food and a certain right. kind of Italian obsession with the preparation of food.
Right. Yeah, it is. Although we do use risotto at the beginning.
Yes, that's right. And yeah. the clientele is very angry because it's not a big portion, and they even ask for pasta on the
right,
side.
Exactly. You know, we're not giving them pasta, only if it's appropriate. And that's sort of the point of the film is it's fine, and we love pasta, and I love pasta. I go through withdrawal if I don't have it every couple of days. But let's have it when it's appropriate. And so what we're saying is let's have those images of Italians. Let's bring those things into play when they are organic to the story. Let's not impose them on the film or the characters.
While you were writing and then shooting the film, did you go to a lot of restaurants to get a sense of the atmosphere in different restaurants and the people there, and just pick up on little things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For years and years and years, it went on. I ended up peaking at Le Madre in New York, which is this great restaurant on 17th Street. And I met a guy named Johnny Scapin, who has since become a friend. He's the head chef there. And I worked with him for like a year and a half, on and off, in the kitchen. And he taught me a great deal. But before that, I had gone to all different kinds of restaurants, and I would always make notes and talk to people, torture the owner or, you know, the waiter or whomever, asking endless questions. And it was fascinating, I have to say. It was so fascinating. And it let me know that we were on the right track when we were writing.
In the movie, you're not the chef. I mean, you're the you're the business oriented brother.
Mm-hmm.
But there are times when you're in the kitchen slicing vegetables or, you know, whipping up eggs, and you slice and whip with the confidence of somebody who really knows how to cook, who's very familiar with the kitchen. Is this something that you learned from understudying the chef?
Yes, yeah, I did. I mean, I have always cooked. I mean, I grew up in a family that is food obsessed. So, you know, I was always cooking and learned how to cook. But I really learned from this guy a great deal, you know, how to chop. You know, it was, you know, I'd go in and start chopping an onion at first, and it was really humiliating. You know, he was a nervous wreck that I was going to cut my fingers off. He taught me a great deal, to be comfortable around that space. And I had to be comfortable around that space as an actor, but also as a director. I had to be able to tell people what to do and where I put the camera and so on and so forth. So it was very important that I knew as much as possible.
What was your food like at home when you were growing up?
Great. Just incredible. In fact, I'm trying to put together like a cookbook now with my mother and Johnny, because I really want her recipes and the recipes of my family to be known, because it was just such a great way to grow up. The food was incredible. My mother became an incredibly sophisticated cook over the years. And, you know, I'd bring these enormous lunches to school, these sort of gourmet meals, you know, and everybody else had peanut butter and jelly.
What would you take to school? I had tuna fish on white bread a lot. What did you have?
No, I never had that. No, I had tuna fish, but it was usually on a nice Italian bread, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, all different things. You'd bring a veal cutlet sandwich or an eggplant sandwich or, God knows what, you know, so much stuff. And I was very thin and small, but I ate for 10 men. So I would bring my lunch in a, you know, when you go to the grocery store and you get like a regular bag for your groceries? That's what I brought my lunch in, because like the little lunch bags were too small to fit all the food I had. So maybe it's disgusting, but I ate like a king.
Now, there's an entire scene in your movie toward the end that's what's happening in the scene. I mean, there's an emotional subtext, of course, but what you actually see in the scene is your character breaking eggs, beating the eggs, putting the eggs in oil into the frying pan, flipping the eggs, putting them on the plate, eating them. This all happens in real time.
Right.
And I thought that was actually kind of brave. You know, to spend that much time following your character making these eggs. And again, there's a lot of emotional stuff happening beneath the surface, but there's no dialogue during the scene. There's no music. It's just completely quiet. Tell me about that scene.
Well, it seemed, in a way, it was an experiment, I guess. It seemed, first of all, the best way to get across what we wanted to get across. After the brothers have this huge scene on the beach, it seemed
fighting.
It seemed what were they going to say? And you know, so many things run through your head. And my cousin and I, as I said, we wrote this together. And you think, well, this could happen, that could happen, this could happen. What could they say? And we realized nothing. Best if they say nothing. So, but what was very important to me was after the cacophony that goes on during the party sequence and the fight on the beach and the stimuli that's sort of coming at the audience and that the characters in the film are getting, we need to go back to square one, and we need to see the effects on these people of this night that they've put together. And the best way to do it was to just show them going about the most simple act and cooking the most simple thing. And also to have my character cook, because he's not the cook, and to have him cook eggs seemed to be appropriate. It's a beginning to me.
Did you have anybody tell you this scene goes on too long? You should just like do some inner cutting so you don't have to watch the eggs from beginning to end.
Oh, sure. Yeah, but I didn't listen to him because I knew it worked, and I knew it would work. And even when we had the when we showed people the script, you know, they'd see the script and they'd say, well, this is great, but, you know, where's the ending? And you say, well, that is the ending. I say, well, yeah, but, you know, what does that mean? So, I don't know what it means, you know, but there's no dialogue, there's no this. And I say, well, it will work. I know it'll work, and you have to trust me as an actor. I know the kind of information that I can get across, and somebody like Tony, who's so good, and Mark Anthony, that we can get across just with our bodies. And by the end of the film, the audience should know should know the character so well that they should be almost like a family member or like a lover. So they should know that when I walk into a room or Tony walks into a room, if our head is turned a certain way, if our body is like this, they know what we're feeling. And you should be able to watch that. If you care about them, you should be able to watch it really forever, I think, like you watch somebody that you care about, like you can watch someone you care about forever. So, yeah, people did say, you know, don't, maybe this, maybe you could put the credits over that or something horrible, you know. And I'd say, no, it's okay. And it's very interesting in the theaters. I mean, we took a big chance. I mean, but it's very interesting in the theaters. You can hear a pin drop. And I'm so thankful because I didn't do any coverage, you know.
tell what coverage means.
Coverage meaning that I didn't go in for any close-ups. I didn't shoot Mark Anthony from another angle and then shoot me and then shoot Tony entering and all that stuff. It's one take, and that's all there is to it. And either it was going to work or it wasn't going to work. And if it didn't work, then I was really screwed.
Now, you had to think of editing and pacing in this movie, mm-hmm. in the way that you've never had to before, because, you know, in the past you've just been acting your role and you don't have to worry about the larger film process. What did you do to get a sense of editing and pacing? I mean, did you go back and study certain films that you particularly love?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Over and over and over again.
Which were the films you looked at over and over?
Well, there's a handful of them that I kept going back to. And I'd sort of try to look at other films, and then I'd just keep going back to these movies. La Dolce Vita was one. 8 and a Half was another. A Sunday in the Country by Tavernier is one. Rules of the Game, Raging Bull, films like that.
What doesn't fit in this picture category? Raging Bull. I mean, there are some scenes, like the boxing scenes, that are so mm-hmm. quickly cut.
Right.
And that's really different from the pace of your film or from the other films that you've mentioned.
Yeah, it is. But also, if you look at the dialogue scenes, I mean, the lengthy dialogue scenes,
True.
They're so beautifully shot.
True. Right.
A lot of masters, and the coverage is very simple and straightforward. Mm-hmm. Manhattan was another film, in fact, that I would go to because of almost the entire film is master shots. It's so beautifully constructed, and the pacing is so beautiful.
You said that one of the reasons why you wanted to direct is that you were tired of directors who didn't know how to talk to actors.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the typical problems you've faced when communicating with directors?
Well, I think that a lot of directors will come from a technical background, and that's fine for certain aspects of the film, but there's a huge aspect that, you know, we're leaving out, which is the actors and how they move within the space and how they communicate with each other and how they get your point across. I think the struggle that we all found, and, you know, Campbell felt the same thing, Steve Buscemi, who just directed his own film, I know feels the same way, is that they deal with actors, they speak very generally, and they'll use words like, you know, your attitude in this scene, or, oh, God, I don't even know what else. I mean, because the language is so nebulous. But they really don't understand, most of all, what they don't understand is physicality. And that's why I think you see a lot of coverage, because they only can concentrate on the faces and the words as opposed to the actor's physicality and the space that surrounds the actor and the space that exists in between the actors physically. That is just as important as the close-up to me and the words that are being spoken. And that was something in this film that we wanted to try to make use of. And it's really, I guess, like an older style of filmmaking. But we trust actors, or we love actors.
Why don't you explain the expressions coverage and master shots?
Okay. Master shot is usually a wide shot, meaning you put a wide angle lens on and you can see all of the action that's happening in the room and you play the scene from beginning to end. Coverage would be then going in for specific moments, going in with tighter lenses. You would go in and do something like a medium shot, which would be, let's say, from the waist up, and then you would go into a close-up. And you usually go into the close-up on the more poignant moment of the scene, the medium shot for the middle of the scene, and the master shot for the opening of the scene. That's a standard sort of formula.
Now, as an actor, what are some of the things that you like and don't like about the close-up versus the master shot?
What I don't like about the close-up is I feel that it's really overused. I feel that what it does is it gives everything the same weight if it is overused. If you're going to use it, it must be used sparingly. As much as I love people's faces, I love their bodies equally as much. And a person's hand or their foot can tell as much as their eyes, I think. So I like to be able to see the whole picture when the whole picture should be seen. I don't think, you know, everything should be in a master shot.
My guest is Stanley Tucci, and he co-directed, co-wrote, and stars in the new movie, Big Night. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stanley Tucci, and he co-wrote, co-directed, and stars in the new movie, Big Night. Now, a lot of our listeners know you from the role of Richard Cross, the billionaire murder suspect in Murder One.
Right.
How did you get that part?
Well, it all happened at the same time we got the money for the movie, so it was a very sort of hectic time. I auditioned for another part. I auditioned for the part that Dylan Baker played in the series. And they said, why don't you try reading this other part? It was written for like a 60-year-old man. And I thought, thanks a lot. You know? I mean, I've lost my hair, but I mean, come on. so I read it, and they wanted me to play it, and they adapted the role for me. They made him a little younger, thank God. And so I actually turned it down first because I was afraid that I couldn't do both things. But the schedule worked out just fine. The guys at Reicher, who produced our movie, gave the okay that I could be shooting the film during the pilot during a small portion of our pre-production period, and then I would edit the film in L.A. I would shoot the series in L.A. and I'd edit the film in New York, and that was sort of a nightmare. But that's how it all came about. And Stephen Bochco was just, and the people there were extraordinary. I mean, they really helped work around my schedule, which wasn't easy.
Now, this one trial lasted all season, and viewers didn't find out if you did it or not until the very end. When did you find out?
Well, I had to lie to the press for a long time and say that I didn't know what was happening. But I did know after, like, the third episode or something, because I was very frustrated. I went to them, and I said, look, this is very hard for me to do. I don't know what the hell is going on. How am I supposed to act this? You know, besides I have jet lag all the time, you know, what what can I do here? And Stephen called me in and said, look, this is basically what's going to happen, I think. And I said, okay, that helps me. And then I lied to everyone, including the cast members.
Wow.
And but I found out later that they all had been told things. But I still didn't really believe them when they told me. I thought they were making it up just to make me feel better because he really wanted to keep it a secret. And I don't blame him, you know. He's got a lot riding on it.
So the acting problem that the secrecy posed for you is that you didn't know, if you didn't know if you were guilty or innocent, you didn't know whether you were covering up or telling the truth.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, to me it was that, but it was even more than that. I needed to know a little bit more about the character and the relationships between everyone, and they weren't really giving that out. So that was really important to me. To me, it was also, you know, if you're guilty, you're going to act like you're innocent, and if you're innocent, you're going to act like you're innocent. So it doesn't really make a difference if you know or not, in a way. So it was really more the relationships.
But the difference is, if you're innocent, you'll just be innocent, whereas if you're guilty, you will act innocent. There'll be a certain amount of acting involved, right?
No. You have to be innocent. You can't act innocent. You have to be innocent.
No. But I mean, the real person would be acting innocent. And wouldn't you want to pick up on the fact that they're being a little phony there, that they're acting innocent as opposed to just being innocent?
No. Because then it gives it away.
Uh-huh.
Then you give it away, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, if I'm guilty and I give away to the audience that I'm acting innocent, well, then the show's over.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to completely be innocent, whether I know that I'm... I mean, I did find out that I wasn't guilty, of course, so, you know. But even when I didn't know I was guilty, I was assuming that I was going to be the guy for a while, you know. I just pretended I was completely innocent.
Do you know what your next movie is going to be? Do you have plans to write and direct another one?
I do. I wrote a film that's a farcical comedy. I wrote it while we were trying to get the money for Big Night. And I actually was hoping I'd be in pre-production right now or shooting right now.
Gee, I'm not keeping you, am I?
No. But the money fell through.
Oh.
So we're out trying to get the dough again. And
right.
it's looking pretty good. So I hope it happens. But it'll be with the same... a lot of the same people, and then some more on top of that. I just hope to have a little more money this time.
Right.
So I don't have to take another job during the editing process.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Stanley Tucci co-wrote, co-directed, and stars in the new movie Big Night. Big Night will probably help revive interest in Louis Prima, whose music was also featured in the recent films Casino and Smoke. We'll close with his recording of Pennies from Heaven.
And every time it rains, pennies from heaven.
Shoo-be-doo-be.
Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
Shoo-be-doo-be.
You'll find your fortune falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is up, upside down, and trade them for a package of sunshine and ravioli.
Macaroni!
If you want the things you love, you must have a pizzaoli, baby. And when you hear thunder, don't run under a tree. There'll be pennies from heaven for you and me. Now come over here, boy, Sam. And every time it rains. And don't you know it's crocodiles? Every time it rains, and don't you know it's crocodiles? You'll find your fortune falling all over town, all over town, all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is upside down, sweet lip up. Or how about the hills of white? Gigala mahungli. Zumaluta zumbulut. Oh, bodily boys, oi. Hey, Baba, ha, boy. Ooh, Baba, ha, man. Woody, woo. Ooh. I knew I'd get you. Let's go. Let's go.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Louisa Shafia. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.